Today on the 21st Show, it's Memorial Day. We'll talk about searching for tens of thousands of American military personnel who are still missing, from World War II all the way up to the Gulf War. And we'll hear the stories of a few Illinoisans who've finally been accounted for in just the past few years. Plus, we'll talk about the symbolism and mythology of soldiers thought lost in Vietnam with Thomas M. Hawley, author of The Remains of War, Bodies, Politics, and the Search for American Soldiers Unaccounted for in Southeast Asia. I'm Brian Mackey, and that's all coming up this Memorial Day on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Bloomington-Normal, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today is Memorial Day, when we remember the men and women of the armed forces who gave their lives in the service of our country. It was Edmund B. Whitman, superintendent of national cemeteries after the Civil War, who said, "That nation which respects and honors its dead shall ever be respected and honored itself." We've practiced that for decades, sometimes even while we are still at war, as evidenced in this 1945 Memorial Day newsreel, which of course was in the final days of World War II.
At Anzio, Italy, scene of one of our bloodiest landings, a group of Rangers pays a visit to the fields where they fought. Captured by the Germans and freed by the Russians in Poland, they're on their way home. First, they visit the cemetery where many of their buddies lay buried for a last silent farewell. Signal Corps cameras show that they have remembered. Memorial Day will be every day for them, for you can't forget the man who died at your side. Let us remember the best Memorial Day tribute we can pay. Work harder for final victory.
Among the many men and women we remember today are prisoners of war and those who are remembered but missing in action. One estimate is that around 81,000 Americans are still missing from World War II, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Cold War, even the Gulf War. The work to find these soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines is still ongoing decades later. And every year, dozens, if not hundreds of families are getting answers. That's the focus of an agency in the Department of Defense. It's called the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA, and it works around the world to search for the missing. The motto of a predecessor group, the Joint POW/MIA Accounting Command, was, "Until they are home." C. Elliot Moore, a forensic anthropologist for the agency, talked to the Associated Press in 2004 about what motivated his work.
It gives me a lot of personal satisfaction in what I'm doing and recovering the remains of those who paid the ultimate sacrifice to provide answers and questions to the families of their loved ones so they will know what really happened.
So on this Memorial Day, we are going to talk about those searches and tell some of the stories of Illinoisans who, just in the past few years, have finally been accounted for. We'd love to hear what you think about our program. Send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. We begin today with Emily Tarbett Hust, who's actively involved in this work as a forensic anthropologist at the Defense POW/MIA Accounting Agency. Emily, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So there are so many of these stories we could be talking about. Your work has been focused on the Battle of Tarawa on the Pacific Front in World War II. And one of the men involved in that fight was a Chicago-born Marine sergeant named Robert F. Van Heck. He was 25 years old, November 1943. He lands on the Tarawa Atoll called the Gilbert Islands. Pick up the story from there. What happens next?
So with Sergeant Van Heck, so I guess it's important to kind of back up a little bit and explain that the U.S. was trying to gain a more offensive position in the Central Pacific. And so they had set their sights on Tarawa, more specifically on the airstrip that was located on the largest island. And the Japanese had spent the entire past year building up their defensive capabilities on that island. And so it took months of planning. And on November 20th of 1943, about 18,000 Marines began the invasion on Baisieux. And that's what started the Battle of Tarawa. So for Sergeant Van Heck, he was assigned to the 2nd Amphibious Tractor Battalion of the 2nd Marine Division. And during that battle, he was assigned to what's called an LVT, a landing vehicle tract. It's an amphibious vehicle, think almost like a duck boat, kind of. And he was assigned to LVT 13. And it's always really neat to see what the historians are able to pull out of the historical records. They can kind of get a little personality come out through what we know about what happened. And so the driver of the LVT that Sergeant Van Heck was assigned actually thought the number 13 was remarkably unlucky. And so he renumbered it 13 and a half and would only address it as the name Wabbit Twax. And so you just kind of see some of their personality come through, remembering that these are 20 to 25-year-old young men. So they were able to successfully land their LVT on one of the beaches alongside numerous other LVTs. But shortly after they landed, two explosions kind of rocked the front and the back and ended up killing both the driver and Sergeant Van Heck. And although we were able to figure out where, from historical records, where the driver was buried, there was never any record of where Van Heck had ended up buried, which is a problem kind of across Tarawa in general. Things happened really fast. A lot of cemeteries end up being kind of hastily created. So our historical records are not always the best or the most complete for the island of Baisieux.
So it's a situation where so many Marines are dying in quick succession that their peers are just trying to get them buried, and maybe they don't have the best records. Is that what you're saying happened?
Yeah. So we have some historical records, but things, yeah, there wasn't. They weren't expecting such a high casualty rate. And then the battle went on for so long. It was about 76 hours. And then within a day of them securing the island, the Marines were reassigned and they were sent back to Hawaii to prepare for their next mission. And so they left really quickly afterwards, only leaving behind a small group of Navy to build it up into a functional military base.
So what happens in the decades between then and, Van Heck's eventual identification 80 years later?
Sure. So initially, the Navy, they were building up the island into a functional military base, and they replaced a lot of the simple burial markers the Marines had initially used with white crosses and memorials. But when they did that, they ended up changing the layout of the cemeteries, something we call cemetery beautification. They put the crosses in neat rows, they evenly spaced them apart, but they didn't actually disinter any remains when they did that. And so the burial markers now no longer match where people are buried.
Oh,
And so
wow.
when.
So it looks like a classic military cemetery people have seen, in film, if not in real life. But that doesn't necessarily line up what's happening beneath the surface.
No, it doesn't. So that meant that a lot of cemeteries were either lost or took a while to find. So after the war was over, the 604th Graves Registration Company arrived in Tarawa to recover and identify fallen service members, but they really struggled due to those beautification efforts. They were able to get some chaplains who were on island and oversaw the burials to come with and help locate things. And with that, they were able to recover about 500 sets of remains, which left probably about 350 sets of remains still on the island.
So this group
And so
is
they.
working in the 1940s, shortly after the war. So this is a very
Yes.
much a present effort at the time, but they're limited in what they can get done.
Exactly. And so they did as much as they could at the time on site and were able to identify about 300 of those 500 individuals. And then what they couldn't identify was sent to an identification laboratory located in Hawaii at the time. And they were able to identify about another 100. And then the remaining 100 of those 500 were given an unknown designator and buried in the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, which we affectionately call the Punchbowl Cemetery here in Hawaii because it is located in a volcano crater. And so it kind of looks like a punchbowl.
So, and this is, I mean, maybe this seems obvious, but it's maybe worth repeating. This is before DNA, I guess, before we even understood what DNA was, really, right? And certainly before any sort of DNA analysis. So, what were there other efforts over the years, or did these remains basically stay where they were for decades?
Yeah, they've basically been in the Punchbowl Cemetery since 1949, up until 2016 when the DPA began the effort to disinter all of the Tarawa remains.
So, what is that work like, actually physically doing it? I mean, are there machines that come in? Or, I got to imagine it's, there are aspects of this that are probably rather unpleasant, in the moment, even meaningful as it may be.
Yes, we work really closely with the runners of the National Memorial Cemetery, and they'll come out. We do these about every other week right now, working on other conflicts, Korean War primarily. And so they'll bring out their equipment. They have, yeah, machinery, and then guys who they've got it down to an art at this point. They know exactly how they're going to approach it. They know how deep the caskets are, and then we'll have an archaeologist on site in case anything happens where the caskets, which are 80 years old at this point, if there's any damage to them, if they sometimes when we lift them up, the bottom might fall out or something. So we have archaeologists on site watching the whole process, and then they'll get brought into the lab and processed here by our project teams.
So talk about what that is like. I mean, Van Heck was ultimately identified after 80 years. What is that? How does that actually come about?
Sure. So when we get a case in, the first thing is it has to be inventoried. And so because these have gone through so many different identification efforts at this point, we have to assess and make sure what we're dealing with is one individual. Burials were really close together. Things were recovered in a, not by anthropologists, not by archaeologists, and were initially buried and then disinterred and then buried again. And so we have to assess and make sure what we're dealing with is something that we can conclusively determine is one individual. And with that, we'll use anthropology, we'll use DNA analysis, and then we're also able to use isotope analysis for that. And with that information, we're able to kind of go forward and figure out what we have to do from there to continue figuring out exactly who that individual is.
Can you say more about what you mean when you say we'll use anthropology? I think that
Sure.
people can imagine DNA analysis. We've all seen CSI. What does it mean to use anthropology to do this work?
So we're able to use the articular surfaces, so where your joints fit together, we're able to take the skeletal remains and make sure that those are consistent with one another. That can deal with size, the type of surface. There's a lot of uniqueness in the body loss skeletal variation that we're able to look at. And then we're able to look across the body. So symmetrically, do both of these arms look like they could be in the same individual? And then some of it's just aging markers. If we're doing an age analysis and the skull appears to be an extremely young individual and the postcranial elements appear to be a very old individual, it's a pretty clear sign that we're dealing with something that had gotten swapped at some point.
Interesting. So would this kind of effort been possible if you went back, I don't know, 10, 20, 50 years ago?
Some of it, the anthropology is very similar to what they were trying to do at the identification laboratory in Hawaii in 1949. A lot of our anthropology, like obviously we improve our methods over time. We have more reference samples now. We have more precise methodology, but a lot of the anthropology is very similar. What's changed a lot is our DNA analysis and our ability to make those comparisons and more positively identify individuals.
So I know today that service members have DNA records for identification purposes when they enter the service. I got to imagine that was not the case in, in the lead up in the mobilization in World War II or even Korea. What are you matching to?
So we have a database of family reference samples. We work really closely with the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory, known as AFDL, and they help us collect reference samples from family members. So for Van Heck, it was a maternal niece that was donated DNA and was able to contribute to the comparison. Sometimes it's siblings, distant relatives. It varies quite a bit, but yeah, it's all about families.
That's interesting because you would imagine that a lot of these young men in particular were not married. They were so young. It certainly might not have had children in many cases. So that I imagine complicates that. All right. So you get through the process, you've done the analysis, you have a match. What happens next?
So we write up reports. We have a medical examiner on site who helps us. She kind of compiles all the information that we've gotten from our dental team, from our DNA from the Anthro team, and she's able to compile all of that into a medical examiner report, and then the death certificate gets finalized. We go through a copy editing process, and the identification gets made, and then we notify the service casualty officers, who contact the family, and it goes on from there.
Do you, as a person doing this work, do you ever get to connect with the families when they find out about their loved ones, or do they have questions for you, or are you separate from that process?
It really depends on the family. Sometimes they'll come in for tours, or they'll come in for the remains releases. Hawaii is a bit of a trek for a lot of people, so it isn't a terribly common process, and it's not something that I've gotten the chance to be extremely involved in, but it does happen. Family members will come in, especially from Korean War and Vietnam War, where we're dealing with slightly more closely related individuals typically.
Yeah, that makes sense. One imagines that the World War II generation, there's just not that many siblings left for these identifications.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. All right, we have to take a break. When we return, we will continue my conversation with Emily Tarbett Hust of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency. We'll share more stories of those we are remembering on this Memorial Day. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and today is Memorial Day. We are talking about the ongoing work to identify the soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who died fighting for our country in World War II and other wars. As former President Franklin Roosevelt put it in a 1942 fireside chat, the people who served are soldiers, but they're also something more.
Our soldiers and sailors are members of well-disciplined units, but they're still and forever individuals, free individuals. They're farmers and workers, businessmen, professional men, artists, clerks. They are the United States of America. That is why they fight.
We could be talking about U.S. Army Private First Class Robert L. Bryant from Bloomington, Illinois, who died at age 23 in World War II and was accounted for just last year. Or U.S. Army Air Force's Second Lieutenant Justice J. Butala from Chicago, killed at 24 in World War II and accounted for just in January. But instead today we're focusing on one story, Chicago-born Marine Corps Sergeant Robert F. Van Heck. Identifying the missing is the jurisdiction of the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, and we are talking about this work with Emily Tarbett Hust. She is a forensic anthropologist there. No calls today, but let us know what you think by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, Emily, we are talking about one story out of many here, but how does this fit into the bigger picture of the work you do?
It's a good example of just how many people go into a single identification. You know, we have to work with our historians to figure out who a case might be. What is our list of possible candidates? We have to work with our archaeologists, who are the ones who go out and recover the remains, our anthropologists, who kind of figure out what path our case is going to go forward. And there's just so many different people who have to be involved with different specialties. And and all of those to come together for one identification. I think it really shows the commitment of our agency to just never give up on a case. We disinterred Sergeant Van Heck in 2016 after 80 years, and it took 4 or 5 years for us to have a path forward, but we were still able to do it. And you know, every identification means something.
What made you want to get into this type of work?
It's funny. When I was 12, a librarian gave me a book by accident called Death Acre, thinking it was a mystery book. And it was actually a book that was by Dr. Bill Bass, who is a forensic anthropologist who started one of the first body donation facilities in Tennessee. And that kind of kickstarted me forward. And then I found my way to DPA because my grandfather was in the Korean War. And so I had done some historian internship work with someone who writes books on the Korean War. And so kind of those two paths of interest in the military and interest in my grandfather's history and interest in forensic anthropology kind of collided and ended up with me here.
What does it feel like to get an answer to a question that has been an unsolved mystery for decades?
It's incredibly rewarding. I think that's the biggest part about this job. I've been with the DPA for about 6.5 years now. And in those 6.5 years, I don't think any day has ever felt the same. Everything's a little bit different. Every challenge is a little bit new. And every approach has to be shaped to match those challenges. And so it's just one of those things that every day is its own kind of reward when you understand how much your work matters to people. It's really a dream to be able to participate in this.
Do you feel like a connection with these men and their families?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, it's amazing how much you can learn just between the historical context and looking at someone's remains. You get to know them, and you can see that they broke their arm when they were a kid and it healed really well. And you can see if they had their nose broken, and you get to kind of know them in a way that I don't think you get to just by reading the historical records. But then obviously the historical records give you context into who they were and who they participated with, and you know, the humor that they might have had. So you get to know them when you're working on a case for years at a time, trying to figure out that answer. And so getting to watch them go home is always a really big moving piece.
I would imagine there's also some visibility into the horror of war, the trauma of war as well. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing is always to see how young they all were.
Yeah. How does it feel for you when they're reunited with families? In Van Heck's case, he had a funeral in Hillside, Illinois this past January.
Yeah. I mean, it's wild how much impact these identifications make after so many years. You know, it's always really, really cool to see the articles that come out of this, of the funerals, and the quotes of the family members that are still able to go and pay their respects to them, and how much that closure means to them. We always share the articles around the lab whenever a funeral happens and it makes the news. We always make sure to put it out in a lab-wide email so we can all kind of all see the impact that our work is doing.
So this program's airing on Memorial Day. I wonder, given your work, what does this day represent to you?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's almost like every day is a type of Memorial Day, I guess. Every day we're working right there alongside the individuals who gave up their lives. We're looking through their historical records. We're analyzing them. We're getting to know them. But Memorial Day is still a really great chance for us to step back and put it all into the big picture. It's really easy when we're doing it every day, day in, day out, to kind of just focus on our little piece. But Memorial Day really helps us take a step back and remember what we really do and who it's for. We have the honor of giving these men back their name, giving them a final resting place where their families can pay their respects to them, and helping bring closure to their story and to their families. That work is really, it's really important, and it really matters. And we'll keep doing it until they all come home.
Emily Tarbett-Hust is a forensic anthropologist at the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency based in Hawaii. Emily, thank you so much for sharing some of your work with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. On this Memorial Day, we've been talking about the ongoing search to account for all the U.S. military personnel who've gone missing in war and how we are still getting answers to some of those stories decades later. In a field full of uncertainty, the Vietnam War has posed many of its own questions. CBS News' Bruce Morton reflected on that in a news report the day the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington was dedicated, back in 1982. You'll also hear words from a man he described simply as a soldier who had come back.
All these people on these walls, my friend, as far as I'm concerned, I wish they could have did something a long time ago. We didn't need no parades or that. All we needed was a little bit of respect.
Respect was all around today. The patriots of an earlier American war talked of risking their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. The lives that were lost remain lost, of course. Young men denied their chance at fortune. But maybe today, the Americans who went to war, and those who didn't, maybe they all regained some honor.
Fewer than 2% of missing U.S. service members overall fought in the Vietnam War. But the body of the missing soldier from that conflict has nevertheless taken on extra significance. Author Thomas M. Hawley writes about that in his book, The Remains of War, Bodies, Politics, and the Search for American Soldiers Unaccounted for in Southeast Asia. The book is going to be 20 years old next month, and its history goes back 30 years to an article in the Honolulu Advertiser in March 1995. More on that in a bit. Hawley's also a professor in political science at Eastern Washington University in Cheney, Washington, and he joins us now. Professor Hawley, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I should say we taped our conversation last week when you were hearing this. Because of that, no calls today, but we always appreciate hearing from you. You can let us know by email at talk@21stshow.org. All right, let's begin with a simple question. Who was Michael Blassie?
Michael Blassie was the soldier whose remains were interred in the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at Arlington National Cemetery. And so he was the one for the Vietnam War. And then there's ones for other wars as well. There was speculation, however, even at the time, that his identity could be discovered. And so after a period of time, his remains were exhumed from the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and through DNA and other forensic testing, they were able to determine his identity. And he was buried appropriately in Missouri, where he is from. And to this day, the Tomb of the Unknown for the Vietnam War remains empty.
Remains empty, and there's still work to prevent it from having to be filled again, I guess. But what does it say to you that it was 26 years, I think, if I have that correct, between when he was killed and when he was finally identified?
Yeah, that's a good question, in part because some identifying information of his was recovered at the time his body was recovered, and it included things like an ID card and stuff like that. But a lot of that stuff got misplaced or lost or whatever. So there was a lot of speculation, even from the beginning, that his identity could be revealed. The flip side of that, though, does concern the sort of the hallowed nature of tombs of unknown soldiers, and especially, of course, at Arlington National Cemetery. That's kind of the place where we go, obviously, to pay respects to our deceased members of the armed forces. And so that really kept people from wanting to tamper with the tomb. It just felt sacrilegious to take a body out of an unknown tomb and try to identify it. And that's an understandable impulse. You know, part of the significance of tombs of unknown soldiers is what they symbolize. And their anonymity is precisely the point, because they stand in for the fallen who, you know, across that particular war, they represent the nation in a particularly symbolic way. It's a very solemn place to visit, as anybody who has been there before has observed, with the changing of the guard and so on and so forth. And so, yeah, I think it seemed so sacrilegious at the time that there was a real reluctance, despite, again, pretty good sense that his identity could be revealed. And finally, the impulse to do so, so to speak, overwhelmed the sacrilegious nature of the tombs of the unknown.
Can you talk in a general way about the sort of military impulse to leave no one behind?
Yeah, that's A really good question, and it's a really important one as well. I think, at least initially and probably obviously, it's out of respect for the sacrifice that a member of the military makes when they are killed on the battlefield. And to leave something, someone behind is almost inherently disrespectful. And it's also a code of honor. I mean, you hear it all the time, and it's true. Leave no one behind. And so, you know, that's kind of an animating principle of military comradeship, I would read it. And so, you know, that too, it's a reflection of the bond as well, I think, that soldiers have with one another.
There's a moment, I think, in I recently read in the memoir of a soldier who was campaigning with U.S. Grant. He was one of his aides. And he talked about, before a battle, seeing some of the Union soldiers sewing up their uniforms. And he thought, what a strange time to be making repairs. But no, it turns out they were sewing slips of paper with their names into the back of their uniform jackets so they could be identified. Because this is a fate. I mean, sometimes people come to accept death, but it seems, I think, somehow worse than death for some people in the military to feel like they won't be accounted for, right?
I think that's a really perceptive point. And it's one thing to make the ultimate sacrifice for your country. It's another thing not to be repatriated, because that does feel a little bit like an abandonment. And it feels, I think, potentially disrespectful. And so, yeah, that story from the Civil War, I'm familiar with that as well. And I find that very striking and really representative of what you just mentioned, that maybe the fear of never being identified again actually is greater than the fear of death, especially in the Civil War. I think virtually everybody knew they were going to die. And so to take steps like that, I think is really quite remarkable. And I think you could make the argument, I don't know if this is 100% true, but I wouldn't be surprised, that that's kind of the beginning of the advent of the dog tag.
Mm.
You know, as a means of at least trying to have some identifying information on a soldier, should he be killed in action.
Yeah. What does it mean? Talk about the ways that the U.S. commemorates its war dead and some of the meanings those have had over time.
Yeah, I think, the United States is in a unique position in a lot of ways. And part of that is because of a long string of victorious military adventures throughout the 19th and 20th centuries. And so memorializing American soldiers throughout the decades has been more triumphalist and celebratory than it has virtually any other thing. And so there's a whole host of symbolic codes and other ways of memorializing members of the military that are kind of baked into the way that we think about wars and the war dead in the United States and U.S. history. And that's why the Vietnam War is such a departure and therefore so much more difficult to memorialize, because the triumphalist narrative doesn't work, obviously. And the defeat obviously doesn't work either. And then the legacy of the Vietnam War, having been as complicated as it has been and still is, also makes it much more difficult to memorialize that war. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial is a good example of a departure from a lot of, probably all of the memorials in the Washington Mall. Its design is really quite striking, and it is reflective, I think, of some of the difficulties that Americans now face and have faced when it comes to thinking back and memorializing the Vietnam War.
Yeah. All right. We are going to take another break on the program. When we return, we'll have more with Thomas Hawley, author of The Remains of War: Bodies, Politics, and the Search for American Soldiers Unaccounted for in Southeast Asia. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
I was under the dryer when the telegram came. Private John C. Miller was shot down.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and this is Pat Boone.
In November 1969, through North Vietnam skies, Rescue pilots searched the jungle floor. Captain Richard Hall was down, his thunder chief was lost. No parachute was seen mid battle's roar. Missing in action.
Today is Memorial Day, and we've been reflecting on the many thousands of American military personnel who remain missing decades after their conflicts ended, and the ways we are still learning what became of some of them. We've been talking for this part of the show with Thomas M. Hawley, who wrote about how the Vietnam War, which the song you just heard talked about, has taken on special significance in these searches. His book is called The Remains of War. Professor Hawley, so I mentioned at the start that the Vietnam's count of missing is a pretty small share of the overall number of missing U.S. service personnel. But there is a major emphasis on this. It's kind of, as we heard with those songs, we can talk a little more about other versions of pop culture that this was such an important part of. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. In my view, it is yet again tied back to the defeat in Vietnam. The missing in action were, as you point out, a smaller number than any previous American war, but of much, much greater significance. And part of that does have to do with improvements in the ability to recover and identify the remains of military personnel. So that kind of gets the ball rolling, so to speak. It's like, well, we can do this, and so therefore we should do it, which makes complete sense. But another part of it was some amount of ambiguity about what had happened to those whose remains had not been recovered. There was some concern as to whether or not they were being held against their will in Southeast Asia. There happens not to be any evidence for that, but it was nevertheless, top of mind for a lot of people. We've obviously seen many movies that have popularized that theme. So part of the emphasis on the Vietnam War remains was because of these suspicions that perhaps they'd been held against their will in Southeast Asia. And so that took a smaller number of people, but then blew it up into a much, much larger circumstance and arguably a much larger problem than was the case for, say, those missing from World War II.
People who are maybe younger today didn't live through the 1980s may not really appreciate the extent to which this was in the air at the time, right? Those black flags, the wristbands people had. Rambo is one film example. Even something like the 1980s TV show Airwolf. I was recently reminded one of the pilot's motivations in that, the helicopter pilot, is finding his brother who he was convinced was still a POW in Vietnam. Can you just talk about how that was like so ubiquitous in the air at that time?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it really does have a lot to do with the very difficult legacy of the Vietnam War. The defeat in Southeast Asia was just such a shock to the system. And part of what I talk about in the book concerns the tangibility of the remains that are recovered from Southeast Asia and then identified. That provides quite a bit of closure. And so, and not just for families, you know, for the nation, there's like one more incremental step away from the war itself and something that might do something to pacify the very contentious legacy of the war. And two, I think when, especially in the 70s and 80s, when, you know, a lot of, you know, the POWs came home and then a lot of the other veterans had been home or were coming home, that was a very contentious time as well. And I think it's fair to say that the living veterans who returned back to the United States felt in many cases as abandoned as their unidentified counterparts in Southeast Asia. And so those two things really converge in the 1980s, especially. And then, you know, you throw the Vietnam Veterans Memorial into the mix, which opens in 1982. And that, of course, was very contentious as well. And so it just kept on being the case that, you know, the Vietnam War, it was just all around all the time. And then, as you point out, people who grew up in the 1980s might not necessarily remember that.
Maybe we can actually pause to talk about the Vietnam Memorial. I know that could be an entire other book, and it absolutely has been. But why it was so different, why it was such a departure, and frankly, how it's influenced. I mean, it has so influenced other memorials. Every memorial to come since then is now so much more personal and less about the collective.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I'm going to start with that. The degree to which it's personal is so striking. And one of the things that makes it that way is that the black granite is very highly polished. And so you can see the reflection of your face or your body when you're standing there looking at the names. And so there's a connection there that's really, really cool when you're there. There's a couple of other things that are unique and I think extremely both important and powerful about it. One of them is that instead of being listed alphabetically, the names are listed chronologically, starting in 1957 and going all the way around to 1975. And you start your visit at the apex of the memorial, and then you go around to the right. So at the beginning, 1957, you go all the way around back and then back down the other V, or the other side of the V, and you end in 1975. And it is an incredible sensation to walk down into that. If the wall at that point at the apex is like 12 feet tall, and so you feel very much immersed in this highly emotionally charged environment. And then, you know, a couple of other things. One, it was designed by an Asian American woman who was an undergraduate in a funerary arts class in college. And it's like people found out about her identity and there was a lot of controversy about that. And then a lot of it's been really controversial, but the other part of it is that it's not triumphalist. You know, it's not a statue. A lot of people were unhappy that it was black. And so because it's so outside of the norm of how wars are typically memorialized, and especially for Americans, as we were just talking about, yeah, it got a lot of people's hackles up. But after it opened, I mean, it almost immediately became the most visited memorial on the Washington Mall. And it's still, of course, enormously important today. There's actually now a museum that houses artifacts that have been left behind by veterans who come to see the name of a fellow soldier of theirs. That's a really powerful dimension of it, too. And so happily, that controversy died down and has now been replaced with a great deal of admiration for that memorial.
And as we said, it's really influenced every, you know, major memorial I can think of that's come after that, be it 9/11 mm-hmm. or Oklahoma City. It really does individualize the victims of those.
That's another really good point, too. As far as putting those individual names up there is concerned, as you pointed out, yeah, it makes it more individualized. It makes it more personal. And one of the other very cool things that people can do is that they can actually put a piece of paper up there with a pencil, make a rubbing of the name. And so it, you know, comes off on that piece of paper. You see a lot of people doing that. And yeah, you're right. The way that memorial has influenced others is quite striking as well.
Let's talk. You talk about how the Vietnam War, it's almost become a matter of victimhood for the United States. And, you know, there's maybe even some amount of like trying to get back at Vietnam for how the war ended. I mean, I wonder how you've seen that play out in the past 50 years.
Yeah, that was an especially prominent theme in the immediate aftermath of the fall of Saigon in 1975. And of course, it had gotten started before that. But yeah, it was tough, not just because of having lost, but having lost to Asians. To be perfectly frank about it, that was a major issue. And so the racial dimension of the controversy over the missing was really quite prominent. And that did not help. When you make the reference to sort of a payback, you know, slash revenge kind of an attitude, that was very much in the air at the time, too. And as I say, it didn't help at all, because all it did was make it almost impossible for the Americans to get into Vietnam to look around for their missing. You know, Vietnam wasn't having it. And had the vitriol been greatly reduced, I think this whole process would have been a lot smoother. But because of that vitriol, there was a lot of suspicion, you know, suspicion that the Vietnamese were deliberately holding back remains, which they were. And also suspicion that the United States government wasn't doing enough to attempt to, you know, recover the missing. Also true. And so that just, as I say, really poisoned the well. And it took a long time for the search to take on the look that it has now. It's such a much more cooperative adventure. And it's a much, just the whole attitude around it is different. It's not, in other words, about, you know, you have something of ours, we're going to come get it back. It's much more about the honor and the sacrifice and the significance and symbolism of bringing home the remains of the missing and then positively identifying them.
You know, I grew up, my grandfather fought in World War II. Actually, both of my grandfathers did, but I only had the privilege of knowing one of them. And so that was very top of mind for me. Younger generations, that is ancient history. They will not know those people. And that is, before we know it, that is going to happen with Korea and Vietnam as well. And I wonder if you sense already that, you know, the changes that take place in the way we think about the past are already sort of swallowing up those things that were so real and so present in our culture for so long.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think you're right on. Just to use my students as an example, they're the, you know, Gen Z types, typically 18 to 22 years old. You mentioned the Vietnam War, and you literally could be mentioning something that was 3,500 years ago. And that, I think you're right to point out that a lot of that memory has been overtaken, you know, largely by time, I suppose, but perhaps as well, it's a component of the loss in Vietnam. We, you know, almost every day in the United States is a Memorial Day for the World War II generation. Not so much, of course, for the Vietnam War generation. And, you know, I've often reflected on this too. I'm not quite sure how to fully answer your question or explain this, but I wonder too, because Vietnam was a war of choice, if maybe the sort of not such great taste in the mouth that left might also have, and I can't quite put my finger on the effect, but perhaps has an effect insofar as remembering this particular conflict is either more difficult or less palatable or both.
I had in my notes here to ask you about when maybe the process of relitigating the end of the Vietnam War, when it ends, but I don't know, maybe it already has. What do you think of that?
Yeah, either it has or it hasn't. I think perhaps more that it has, but the legacy of the Vietnam War, I think, will be with us for a long, long time. The hope, of course, is that some lessons were learned. And I suppose reasonable people can disagree as to whether that's the case or not. But yeah, it's, I think, going to be around for a while. It still offers a lot of really important lessons. Maybe that's what I'm getting at. Mm. You know, wars of choice are just intrinsically risky things. And after the public comes to see that the justification that was provided really doesn't hold any water, you know, we've seen this more than once, and that typically doesn't do great things either, increases suspicion, so on and so forth. So unfortunate as that is, I do think that's one of the important legacies of the war and will more than likely continue to be.
Thomas M. Hawley is a professor in political science at Eastern Washington University. His book, which came out 20 years ago next month, is called The Remains of War: Bodies, Politics, and the Search for American Soldiers Unaccounted for in Southeast Asia. Professor Hawley, thank you so much for being with us on this Memorial Day. I really appreciate your time.
And thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
That is all we have time for today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thank you for listening. I hope your Memorial Day is meaningful. We will talk with you again tomorrow.
Thank you.